outline. So thanks for your prayers, and we'll see what happens. The sales of the book are doing very well, as far as I think Zondervan is concerned, and they're very happy about it. So I might have more specific information, but first printing sold out, second printing sold out, third printing sold out, and they're on their fourth printing. And, you know, they try to print for about 3 months, so if they go through three printings in a month, that's very encouraging. Well, taxes. Now, first, does the government have the right to collect taxes? I'm going to skim over this. If you need an outline, hold up your hand. Okay, great. Thank you, Clyde. Oh, way in the back here, people need outlines. And there are a whole bunch of them on the front rows. Keep your hand in the air until you get an outline, and one should come to you. Does government have the right to collect taxes? I expect Barry talked about this. I heard Barry said, taxes, 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 taxes. There I mentioned taxes. So he did, and I think he did say something. He's the economics expert on this. But as far as the Bible is concerned, yes, the government has the right to collect taxes. Matthew 22:17, the Pharisees asked Jesus, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And Jesus' answer, with a denarius in his hand, was, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And, of course, what was Caesar's was that denarius. His picture was on it. And that implies that even with an evil Roman government, not evil, I shouldn't say that, even with an imperfect Roman government doing some evil things, but doing a lot of good things and protecting the peace and the legal system and everything, Jesus said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar. In other words, you have to pay taxes. And Romans 13:6-7, Paul says, because of this you also pay taxes. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Okay, so we've got the principle established. Government has the right to collect taxes. But it's a dangerous power, because when government realizes it can tax, its tendency is to tax more and more and more. And I read this passage a couple of times in the past in 1 Samuel 8, when Samuel warned that the king, once the people got a king, he will take your sons and daughters, he'll take your fields, take your vineyards, take your olive trees, take your crops, and you will be his slaves. Take, 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 take. That's 1 Samuel 8. That's the danger of government. So the question is, number two, should taxes be high or low in an economy? Now think about it for a minute. If the tax rate is 0%, how much money does the government get?
Zero.
Zero. So the government can't function. It can't pay the police and the soldiers who protect us. It can't maintain the roads and the legal system and all of that. So a tax rate of zero doesn't work out. What if the tax rate is 100%?
They get it all.
Yeah. Government takes away everything. Government controls all economic life. It's a very severe form of communism, basically, where government takes everything and then gives you what it thinks you need, and it destroys all human freedom. So somewhere between zero and 100%, a decision has to be made. And I just want to say there, under point two, the third line, just to realize every increase in taxes takes away that much more human freedom. If the government takes $100 from me, then I can't spend that $100 to buy groceries or go on a little day vacation someplace or buy some clothing or whatever. I don't have the choice anymore. The government has decided what to do with it. So taxes have a lot to do with our freedom. Now, I'm going to argue, number three, that there are benefits of lower taxes. Number one, lower taxes encourage business to invest and grow. Why is that? They've got more money left to do it, and if they invest and they start to make some money with lower taxes, what are they thinking? You can keep more of what you earn. So that's an encouragement. All right? And then there are more jobs and lower prices. More jobs because there's more investment. Businesses have the money to invest, and they expand their dry cleaning shop, or they expand their bakery, or they expand their farm, or whatever. And there's more jobs, and there's lower prices because they don't have to pay as high taxes, you get lower prices. Are you happy with lower prices? Yes, okay. And businesses and individuals earn higher incomes. Now, here, number four. Higher incomes are taxed at the lower tax rate. But more tax money still flows into government coffers because people are paying taxes on more income. Now, this is exceptionally important to the current political climate today. And we've got two parties and two sides of this issue. And the Democrats are saying, we can't lower taxes. We're already going in debt as a government. If we lower taxes, we'll go in debt more. We have to be fiscally responsible. We have to raise taxes so we collect more money and so we can pay the government debt. And the Republicans are saying, wait a minute. You know, there's something that happens. After a certain point, if you lower taxes, you're going to collect more money. How can that be? How can you collect more money with lower taxes? If you lower taxes and all of a sudden the economy begins to grow, the government will collect more money because there's more money to be taxed. Well, let me give you an example. Let's see here. Now we're going to give an example of Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith is a small business owner, and Mr. Smith, at a tax rate of 25%, he earns $80,000. 1/4 of that is $20,000 in taxes. Okay? Everybody's following? $60,000 left for himself. Okay? Now, suppose the tax rate in the next year goes to 20%. But with a lower tax rate, Mr. Smith says, I'm going to work a little more because I can keep more of my money. And I might expand my business a little more because I can keep more of my money. This lower tax rate encourages me to work more because government isn't taking away so much. And so let's say it drops to 20% and he earns $110,000 because his business grew, and it happened to everybody, the economy grew. 20% of that is $22,000 taxes. Did the government get more money? It got $2,000 more on a lower tax rate. Amazing. It's not quite a miracle. And does he have more left over? Oh, yes. Instead of $60,000 left, he's got $88,000 left. Now, that phenomenon is put on a graph by economists. And the one you have on your handout, Barry Asma saw it, and he said, Wayne, that's not a very good Laffer curve. You need a better one. So I got a better one, and it's named after Arthur Laffer, an economist who showed this, apparently, to Ronald Reagan on a napkin in a restaurant one time, and it led to these Reagan tax cuts in 1981. And here's the thing. This is the tax rate down at the bottom. If the government taxes zero, and this graph says the government tax revenue. That's how much money the government takes in. If the government tax rate is zero, the government takes in zero. Go all the way over here and put the tax rate up to 100%. Let me ask you, if you work and the government takes 100% of your taxes, so your check comes back, your paycheck comes back and says zero, how many of you are still going to work? I don't see any hands. Nobody would work at 100% tax rate unless you're forced in a slave state or a military state, forced to work. You won't work and get nothing back. So everybody agrees that if the government takes 100% of your earnings, the government gets zero taxes because nobody works. Is that making sense? So what this graph is saying is, for a little while, if it goes to 1% tax, 2% tax, 3%, the government starts getting more money because this is the tax revenue. This is the billions of dollars that the government takes in. But you get over here to say maybe 15, 20, 25%, people aren't quite sure. You get up to this point, and if then you go from 25 to 30% tax rate, people are saying, it's so discouraging for me to work. The government's taking 30, 35, 40% of my earnings, I don't feel like working anymore. I'm going to stay home another week. And the people who have control over small businesses or who have control over their own occupation, they are especially the people who are affected by that higher tax rate. And they say, forget about it. And when you get up to 50, 60, 70%, people are working less and the economy is shrinking and there's less money to tax. And so the government doesn't get very much money anymore. The amount of money that the government is taking in, what's called the tax revenue, goes down, 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 down as you get toward 100%. Does that make sense? Okay, so Arthur Laffer said, President Reagan, you've got a tax rate of 70% on the highest earners. You know what? They don't feel like working very much anymore when you're taking away 70% of what they earn. And so you don't have much incentive for them to earn. Cut the tax rate to 20%, 28% on the highest earners, from 70 down to 28%, and look how much more money the government's going to get. Does that make sense? Because you're going to make the economy grow. You cut taxes, the economy grows, the government gets more money. I saw Barry Asmus draw that same diagram to the chief economic advisor to the prime minister of Albania in Albania when we were there a couple of years ago. And he was walking him through that. And it does make sense. If you cut taxes and the economy grows, the government gets more money from a bigger economy. I'm going to stop there. Is that making sense? Okay. So, did that happen? Yes, that happened. And the Wall Street Journal says that actually happened twice. It happened in 1981 with President Reagan's tax cuts. And it happened in 2001 and 2003 with the Bush tax cuts. Pow, the economy began to take off, and the government took in more tax money. But people themselves had more tax left, had more money left over. Everybody's happy. Now, point C under 3. When thinking about higher or lower taxes in the current situation today, the question is whether one wants to increase human freedom, letting people keep more of their money, also raise more money for government needs, and also help the economy, or whether taking more money from the wealthy is more important than all these three goals. Does that make sense? So there's a question on tax policy. And it seems to me that the question facing the Congress right now is, in a very difficult economic time, in a recession, do we raise taxes, which is going to cripple the economy even more, make people more discouraged about investing, make people more discouraged about growing their businesses? We're going to raise taxes just because we don't want to give more money to the wealthy people that are going to, who knows why. I mean, that's the question. Okay. Now, I want to go on. What about taxes on corporations? It's kind of popular in the media today and in popular culture to say, let's tax those big corporations. They're rich. They can afford it. We'll get more money from them. But if a government imposes high taxes on corporations, the entire society actually pays the tax. Why? Because prices go up. Now, I'm just thinking about the Safeway grocery store. That's a big company, and we have a Safeway not too far from us. Somebody says, let's raise taxes, 5% on Safeway. Now, is Safeway just going to say, oh, well, U.S. government, we like you so much, we've got an extra 5% of our money sitting around doing nothing. We were wondering what to do with this money. Well, why don't we just give it to you in taxes and we'll leave prices just the same because we've got barrels of money just sitting there doing nothing. Are they going to say that? What is Safeway going to do if their taxes go up 5%? They're going to raise their prices. So I think it's a myth to think we can get free money from corporations. If Safeway's taxes go up, Bash's taxes go up, Fry's goes up, Albertson's goes up, all the grocery stores goes up, Walmart goes up, Target goes up, everybody that sells groceries, and all the prices of groceries are going to go up 5%. And so when you say, let's tax corporations, you're saying, do I want to pay higher prices? I think that's what happens. And that's a temptation that I think we should be aware of. So now we've got a problem in the United States. The corporate tax rate, average combined federal and state corporate taxes, is now 39.3% on the money that corporations earn. 39.3%. It's the second highest in the world. The only economy that has a higher corporate tax rate than the U.S. is Japan. And Japan's economy has been stagnant for about 20 years. It's a big economy, but it's been stagnant. And so all these countries in Western Europe and Eastern Europe are cutting their corporate tax rate. Businesses are saying, oh, let's go invest over there. Only got a 15% corporate tax rate. Why should I pay 39.3% here in the United States? And so the high corporate tax rate, and in California and New York and one or two other states, it's even higher than Japan because of state taxes that are added on. It seems to me, therefore, it would be wise to lower the corporate tax rate because it would restore our competitiveness in the world economy, encourage business investment, and it would truly stimulate the economy and would attract more foreign investment to the U.S. because overseas companies say, wow, we don't have to pay as high taxes in the U.S. I think we'll invest here. Skip over number 5 on capital gains tax. You can read that. Income tax rates. Tax rates are, in most countries, progressive. That means if you earn more, you pay a higher percentage. And it's determined by the person's marginal tax rate and their deductions. And I've got a chart there about 2009 tax rates. You see, if you're married and you're filing jointly and you earn up to $16,700, you pay just 10%. But if you earn over $372,000, you pay 35% on the money that goes above that amount. And that's called the marginal tax rate. That is, if you earn another dollar, you pay 35% on it. Okay? Now, is that a fair kind of tax system? And actually, when you see that, because there are deductions and exemptions and things, they don't start falling in the category of any income at all for a little while. And so many people don't pay any tax, income tax. In Israel, there was a flat tax and a head tax, but I don't see that I could support a progressive tax from the Bible. Now, maybe people think it's fair, but I just notice in the Bible, everybody had to give 10%. They had to give a tithe. And so in that second verse down there, Leviticus 27, verses 30 to 31 and 32, a tithe of everything from the land, whether from the grain or from the soil or the fruit from the trees, belongs to the Lord. It is holy to the Lord. The entire tithe, that means one-tenth of the herd and flock, every tenth animal that passes under the shepherd's rod will be holy to the Lord. And if you go over to the next page, there was another tax, the half shekel tax in Exodus 30, and that was what's called a head tax. Everybody had to pay a half shekel. So now we get to this question on point 7. What is fair in tax rate? Isn't it fair for the rich to pay a higher percentage of taxes? Maybe so. Maybe so, and I suppose that's what people have found to be a workable solution in our society. But I'm just thinking through this. It assumes that a rich taxpayer, for some reason, does not deserve to have more money left to live on, and it works at destroying incentives for work and excellence and productivity. If you go to the extreme and the government makes everybody equal, then if a guy makes $50,000 and you tax him 0%, but a guy makes $500,000 and you say, well, he's got too much money, we'll take away 90% of that, or $450,000. Then they both have $50,000 left. But the guy that earned $500,000 isn't going to feel like working very much. Just like if you take, you remember I said if you get 100% taken away, you won't work very much. If you get 90% taken away, you won't work very much either. So it seems to me a better solution is each person deserves what he has legally and fairly earned in each tax year. Rather than the government or the president sitting up in some office and saying, oh, let's see, if people make $250,000, that's too much. We're going to take more away from them. Where do you get that idea? See, the person who makes $250,000 or $500,000, he gets, by and large, the same benefits from the government that you and I get. He gets the same police protection. He gets the same fire protection. He gets the same military protecting his country. He gets the same clean air to breathe because of the pollution standards of the government. All the benefits the government, he's got the same access to the judicial system. All the benefits that government gives us, he gets, and the person earning $50,000 gets. So why should he pay 10 times as much or more? That's the question I'm asking. And it seems to me, rather than saying, oh, I'm going to sit up here in my office and decide $250,000 is too much, you should give more to somebody else. What right does government have to say that? And so when we sit in our chairs in a classroom and say, now let's see, what is fair? How much should somebody have? We don't have any right to do that. I'm saying the whole question is wrong. And my answer to what is fair is, what is fair is what each person has legally earned, that is, without breaking the law. And if you start a business, you start a bakery here in Scottsdale, and it starts to grow, and you make good bakery goods, and you earn $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, if you've earned it fairly, then why should I say you shouldn't have it? So my solution is, point B, each person deserves what he has legally and fairly earned in each year. And taxation, I don't think, should depend on how much each person has left after paying taxes. The laborer deserves his wages. You shall not steal. And Jesus commended the servant whose mina made 10 minas more. He'd been faithful in a little and he was given authority over much. But now, under point 7, number C, here comes an objection. And maybe you're thinking this in your mind. Maybe you're saying, nobody in society should be able to earn $500,000. That's just too much for any one person. My answer is, how did that person earn $500,000 or $1 million from working as a head of some corporation, because some people earn that much? Salaries are determined according to the market demand for certain skills and abilities. And if we don't like it, the way is to change the viewing habits and spending habits of society. Example. My dad keeps complaining to me that baseball players earn millions of dollars. Why do they deserve to earn $6 million or whatever? And I say, Dad, do you watch that show? Do you watch that baseball game on TV? Oh, yeah. Well, you're paying, by watching, you're contributing to the viewership, and that pays the commercials, and that pays a lot of those salaries. Or you say, I don't think an actor should earn $10 million for this movie. Well, do you watch the movie? Oh, yeah. Do you rent the movie? Yeah. Well, you're paying the salary, my goodness. The society is deciding by what it spends who will get paid how much. And if you say, I don't think those Waltons should earn that much as owning, because they're owners of Walmart, well, then do you shop at Walmart? Do you see what I'm saying? The reason people earn a lot in society is that there's a demand for what they're providing. And it seems to me, if we want to have a free society, we should let people be able to decide what they want to spend their money on. If they want to spend their money on baseball games and the baseball players get high salaries, so what? Why should I care? But what I'm saying is, I don't think the government should say, oh, you earn $6 million as a baseball player. That's too much for anybody to have. We're going to take it away from you and give it to somebody else. I don't see the right for government to say that. Okay. That's me. You can differ with me in a few minutes if you wish. Now, point 8, it's good for society if everyone who earns income pays some taxes. But it's destructive to society if most people who earn income pay little or no taxes because of the accountability system. So, point 8b, even people who earned a small amount of income paid a small amount of tax, but some tax. And in Leviticus 12:8, there's a system for an offering that a woman would make after childbirth. She would offer a lamb as a sacrifice. But what if she was poor? It doesn't say she paid nothing. It says if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons. How much do 2 pigeons cost? Not a whole lot, let me tell you. I don't know how you catch them. That's another problem. But 2 pigeons weren't worth as much as a lamb. But she had something, one for a burnt offering, the other for a sin offering, so she paid something. However, in the United States in 2009, nearly half of the citizens, 47%, pay no federal income taxes at all. Oh, because there's so many deductions and exemptions. Now we have a hard situation. 47% of people paying no taxes. Do they care how much the government spends? They say, another $1 billion, another $1 trillion. So what? I don't care. It doesn't affect me. In fact, maybe they could spend more, and maybe I'll get more from the spending. That is not having accountability to the citizens for the government. This means that nearly half of the voters don't care what the government does with the tax rate. Who's paying most of the taxes in the U.S. today? Here are the numbers. The top 50% of wage earners paid 97% of all the taxes in 2006. Whoa. They get the same soldiers and the same police protection and the same judicial system and the same clean air. They get the same benefits from government, but they're paying, but half of us are in the United States are paying for the government for everybody. The bottom half paid less than 3%. And look at this, the top 1%. Now, I know these are very wealthy people, but the top 1% of people who earned income in the United States paid 40% of the income taxes in 2006. 1% of the people paying 40% of the taxes that pay for the government. That has been going up. In 1990, the top 1% paid 25% of all the taxes. 1990, 25%. 2000, the top 1% paid 37%. And 2006, the top 1% paid 40%. Why should that happen? It doesn't seem to be fair to me, but maybe you think differently. Number 10, now this is, maybe I'm going to get in a lot of trouble here by saying this, but as I've thought about this over a long period of time, it seems to me that the economy as a whole and all the people in a nation and the government all gain benefits from lower taxes on the rich. I see one person out here nodding, all right? I see a lot of people saying, wait, you've got some talking to do to explain this to me. I think it's true. I might be wrong, but here's why. When there's lower taxes on everybody, including wealthy people, people are able to keep more money of their own, and that money gets put to work for other people as well in the economy. So let me explain. My example here is my hypothetical person named Richard Rich. Richard Rich, if he doesn't have to pay so much taxes, if he gets to keep more of his money, what can he do with it? There are only three things he can do. Okay. There's three reasonable things he can do. He can save or invest it. If he saves it, he puts it in a bank. And what does the bank do with the money? E.g., what does the bank do with the money? Loans it out so people can build houses or start businesses or something. So if he saves it in a bank, that helps the economy. If he decides to save it by investing it in stock in a company, that's giving money to a company. What's that doing, Bob? It's helping the company expand and more jobs, more productivity. Okay, so wherever he invests, but maybe he's got a business and maybe he decides to add another assembly line to his business, or maybe he decides to produce more goods with that money. He invests, he expands his business. Is that good for the economy? Yeah, because he's producing more. So, okay, option number one, he can save or invest it. That's good. Option number two, he could spend it. He could buy a car. Does that do any good? Yeah, because the car dealer profits from it. The manufacturer of the car profits from it. The gas station attendant who sells them gas. Okay, so spending it is helpful. Or he could give it away to Scottsdale Bible Church. Or some other ministry that some missionary wants to support. That does good for society. So what's your problem? So he can save or invest it. He can spend it. He can give it away. All three of those choices are better than government taking it and saying, we're really wise, we're going to use it really well. Do you see what I'm saying? no matter what the rich person does with his money, he uses it in a way that benefits everybody else, much more than the government taking and saying, we're going to pay more people to file folders, file copies in triplicate in cavernous mountains of file cabinets.
You want to take 5 extra minutes?
Yeah, okay, Jack. Carol?
I think one of the keys in our society, we Christians are required, or we should be giving 10%.
Christians should be giving, yes.
Of our money, no matter what, you know, amount that you make. And the problem I see is that they're either not doing it or the church has lost their way. We are to be helping the poor, the widows. We are just supposed to be doing more.
Yeah.
The government is now doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really sad.
Yeah, Carol, I'm getting that question quite a bit when I do these interviews about my book and we're talking about economics. Well, what about helping the poor and government welfare programs and things? My answer is both. That is, I think the church should do a lot and the government should do a lot. In fact, I had a government official in one region tell me one time, Wayne, if we didn't have churches helping people in our area, we could never keep up with the needs. So there is a lot. I mean, even out of this church, there's a lot going on. But I think you're right, Carol, we could be challenged to do more. Good. Okay. So Jack is saying it's time to wind up and get to questions. Let me do something else here. Page number 11 on the next page. I'm going to do a couple more things just to kind of get to the end. People say, aren't the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer? And I was very interested to find this chart about income mobility in the United States. First quintile is the lowest 20% of earners in the United States. From 1975 to 91, over a period of 16 years, the lowest 20% of income earners in the United States, 98% of them, over that 16 years, rose out of that low-income bracket into the second, third, fourth, or fifth quintile. That is, over that period of 16 years, the poor people didn't stay, the same people weren't poor. What happened was, those were college students earning nothing who started to earn money. They were medical students who were earning nothing, and they went up to the middle 20% or one of the higher 20%. Or they were business people who were taking no salary for 2 or 3 or 4 years while they were building a business, and then the business kicked in and all of a sudden they're up to the fourth quintile. Or they're immigrants who earn almost nothing as they're learning language skills, and then all of a sudden they start a little business and they start to earn money. So 98% of the people who were in the bottom one-fifth went to a higher category in that 16 years. 2% stayed in the same category, so the 2% were perpetually poor. Second quintile, the same, 78% of the people in the second lowest quintile went to a higher quintile. And in the third quintile, 58% went to a higher group. The highest category, the top 20% of wage earners, 31% fell into a lower bracket after a while. Now, maybe they retired and they stopped earning money or something like that. But what this chart tells me is there is amazing mobility of income in the United States. And when we talk about the poor and care for the poor, what happens over time is the people who are in a lower income category generally rise out of that and begin earning money. There are a few percentage who stop, but this means this is a land of incredible opportunity. Is that surprising to you? I thought that was interesting. What about inheritance? I'm going to go on another few minutes. Number 13. I think it is right to be able to leave an inheritance, but no, number 12, the death tax, the estate tax. Is it right for the government to take money from the estate of a taxpayer before he can give it to his children? It seems to me the teachings of the Bible that I've talked about in previous weeks, that private property belongs to individuals, not society or government, means that he should be able to pass it on to whoever he wants to. So, and look at number 13. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, Proverbs 13:22, or Proverbs 19:14. House and wealth are inherited from fathers. Or that next passage, Numbers 27. If a man dies and has no son, you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, you shall give it to his brothers. If he has no brothers, give it to his father's brothers, etc. It doesn't say, if he has no son, you shall give it all to the government. Or if he does have a son, you shall give it all to the government. Or the government shall take it all away. No hint of that at all. In fact, there's a prohibition in Ezekiel 46. The prince shall not take any of the inheritance of the people, thrusting them out of their property. Now, one objection to this, point B under 13, one argument for estate taxes is estate taxes prevent excessive amounts of wealth from accumulating within a few families. Well, what's this whole idea is my response. Who's to decide that something is excessive? Must we assume that wealthy people are likely to misuse their money or use it in harmful ways to society? If they don't use it in illegal ways, why should it be taken away? In fact, an estate tax, what it does is it gives more and more power to the government, which can be much more harmful to a nation. It boils down to the question, who owns the property of a nation? Individuals or the government? I think the Bible's picture is that individuals own it. So I've got an example here. We have Mr. and Mrs. Ole Olafsson. They have come from the old country. I'm Norwegian background, so that's... Okay, so they started a bakery, and they worked hard for their whole lives, and they worked hard, and they built up a business. They had a pretty nice house. It was worth $600,000, and they had $400,000 in savings when they died, and their little bakery, the Norwegian bakery, was worth $1 million. An estate of $2 million. Upon death, if there's no change in the law in the next 12 weeks, we go back to the tax rates of 2001 before the Bush tax cuts, or 2001, I guess. The first $1 million is excluded, but there's a taxable amount of $1 million. Now, Ole and his wife had three children, and the children say, okay, we get this inheritance. We've got the family home, and one of the children is living there already, and they want to keep the home, and they've got the business, and they want to keep the bakery going. But the government says you got to pay taxes on that $1 million. 55%, government says, right now, please give us $550,000 tax. And the children say, wait a minute. This is mom and dad's money. How can you take it away? The government says, sorry, that's the estate tax. You've got to pay $550,000. Now look at the chart and tell me, where are they going to get the $550,000 to pay the tax? Do they have enough cash? Can't pay it out of the $400,000, and they don't have income themselves to pay it. They've got to either sell the family home, or what happens almost all the time, what do they sell? The business. They sell the business. And who gets it? Sara Lee. Or Hostess Cupcakes. Or some big company. And so what happens is the estate tax, in actual fact, ends up giving more and more power to large corporations who buy up these small businesses because the family businesses have to be sold to pay the tax. Is that making sense? So, and then the government, of course, takes more money. But what the studies say is this discourages people from working hard, especially as they begin to say, we've got enough for ourselves, but we don't want to build a business anymore because the government's going to take it all away anyway. Okay, last point. Go over to the last page, the bottom of the last page, point J. What is the best solution to the kind of recession that occurred in 2008 to 2010? The solution that the Obama administration followed was called an economic stimulus. The government is going to spend $814 billion. Now, here's how to figure that. $1 billion, I'm going to argue, costs you $6 per person if you're a taxpayer. The reason I'm going to argue that is this way. The United States population is 300 million, 307 million. $1 billion is about $3 per person. Have I done this before in the class? No, just so, okay, we've got to get a kind of a guideline here. If everybody in the United States, 307 million persons, paid $3, you'd get to about almost $1 billion. You'd get to 900,000 some. So call it for round numbers. Every person puts in $3 to get $1 billion, all right? However, half the people in the United States don't pay taxes. So really, when the government spends $1 billion, if you're a taxpayer, it costs you twice that much. It costs you $6. So that when you're listening to the radio and you say, oh, the government spent $1 billion, you say, whoop, $6 out of my wallet for that billion. If the government spends $100 billion, that's $600 out of your wallet. But the government spent $814 billion. Figure it out. 800 times $6 per person, every taxpayer, that stimulus cost $4,800. That's how much that stimulus package cost you. That is, it wasn't just the government giving away free money. That large sucking sound that you hear in the background is the government vacuum cleaner vacuuming $814 billion out of present or future taxes so it can give back $814 billion. In fact, it probably takes a lot more because it doesn't give back everything it takes. So that's how much it costs. Did it do any good? I don't think so. I don't think so. And here's the reason. It didn't produce goods. Money doesn't produce goods. People produce goods. Imagine this whole class all of a sudden landed on a deserted island. And it had crops, it had animals, but there was no economic system there, and we had to get going. So John says, well, I'm going to start building some huts. So you got huts to live in. Sandy said, okay, I'll help you do that. I'll put the roofs on. And Jack says, I'm going to go find these chickens and get some eggs so we have some eggs to eat. And then Clyde says, and Elaine, we're going to go pick some apples. So all of a sudden, everybody starts being productive. We're making apples, we're getting eggs, we're making huts, etc. And everybody's working at the economy. Then we're all happy because we're all producing. But then a government airplane flies over and it drops $1 million in $100 bills on our island. Does that do any good for anybody? You can't eat $1 million. It's not apples, it's not eggs, it's not huts. It's not producing anything. Adding cash to the economy doesn't make the economy wealthier. It's Clyde and Helene picking apples that makes the economy wealthier, or it's Ole and his wife making bread that makes the economy. It's producing things. So my solution, instead of the government saying, we don't have $814 billion, but we're just going to spend it anyway, and we'll go $814 billion in debt, a better solution would have been, we're going to cut taxes by $814 billion. And you can keep that money yourself. And now Ole and his wife are saying, you know, we're going to work one more year instead of dying. And all of a sudden we got more bread produced in the economy. So the solution, it's not a temporary tax cut, because business people don't make long-term decisions on temporary tax cut. It's a permanent reduction in tax rates. We've got 12 weeks for the Congress to do that. Permanent reduction in all tax rates will get the economy out of the problem it's in. At least that's my suggestion for a solution. That's the end of the lesson and end of taxes. All right. Now, we're supposed to sing, but we're going to take a couple of questions. We might skip the song today. Okay. Oh, right in the front, I'm forgetting your name. Sherry, yeah.
Everything that you explained very well, because even I understand that these principles seem pretty basic and pretty wise. Without getting too political, because this could be any country, what would you give or discern as a possible motive for someone to understand these? Because we have intelligent, not necessarily wise, but intelligent people up there. What is the motive for going in the opposite direction, even making it very difficult, if not impossible, to save and to do the things that you pointed out?
Excellent question, Shirley. Sherry. I'm sorry, Sherry. The motive is, at the heart of political liberalism, is make everybody equal. So the guy making $500,000, the guy making $215,000, it's a combination of saying, he shouldn't have that. That's too much, and I get to decide. If I'm sitting up here in the Oval Office, I mean, it's President Obama saying we've got to spread the wealth. It's power, but I think if you want to say there's a good motive to it, it's people thinking they can do good by making people equal in income and thinking that the only way to do that is by government power doing that. But my argument is it harms everybody, it harms the economy, and according to biblical principles, government doesn't have the right to own property that belongs to individuals and think it should own it. Government has the right to tax to carry on its functions, but not to think it should distribute property among individuals. So there's a basic difference in what we think government should do. Should government equalize everybody's income or tend toward equalization, what they call fairness, or should it be the goal of government to help the economy generally by letting people keep more of their own money so the economy will grow? And that's a fundamental difference, and that is the difference that people are voting on November 2nd. As best I understand it, anyway. Yeah. One or two more. Jack?
Wayne, would you talk for a minute about, I'm sure you have it covered somewhere, I didn't see it here, but regulation, because it seems as though the government now hides a tax within regulation. So if you regulate the energy field or healthcare, we end up paying. Society pays, but it's not called a tax. I'm sure you cover it somewhere.
It's not going to come till chapter 15. But I say on special interest groups, I talk about government regulators who make you jump through more and more hoops and fill out more and more forms and follow more and more regulations. So. And that hinders the, but see, it's the same deal. It's the difference between saying, wait a minute, that's your business, it's your time, it's your money, you have the right to do what you want to with it. That's human liberty, that's belief in liberty, versus saying, I'm going to maximize the government controlling everybody's life and deciding what's good for people, because that's what really people need, is the government telling everybody how to run their lives. So there's a difference in viewpoint. And I think, ultimately, the people who believe in human liberty tend much more to believe that there is a God who controls the universe and who gives moral standards to which people are accountable. And so people should have freedom to follow what they think is best according to God's moral standards, versus people who think that there isn't any God and therefore the most powerful force in the world is government, and government is all we've got to make things right, and we don't have a perfect society yet. Let's see if government can make it perfect. Let's try to make everybody equal. So there's a thinking process that goes on that has to do with people's religious or theological views, I think. One more, E.G.
Just a couple of things that affect this pie, if you will. One, with my involvement with the United Way, I learned that America is a very unusual country compared to most all other countries in that there is much more charitable giving.
Yes, there is.
European countries, other countries, they don't have charities. And the other
not nearly as much.
Pardon?
Not nearly as much.
Yeah, very small.
Yep.
The other big issue here is that over the past century, particularly, I believe, the U.S. government has played with our economy with its tax structure. And not just the rates I'm talking about, but industries that are encouraged to develop by a tax.
Yep.
And it's like the tax congressman in, 86,
yes,
when they changed the taxes on real estate, gutted the value of real estate.
You don't want this product. It's not economically viable. Well, we're going to give a tax rebate for it, so we'll force you to buy it or persuade you to buy it economically. So, yeah, there's a lot of social engineering going on with taxes. As far as European countries, why is there a much lower incident of charities there? Because the government has taken so much money away from people, and the people just let the government care for people. And so we've got to guard against that, the growth of that, too. Okay, so next week, the environment, what God wants us to do about the environment, how he set up the earth to function. We'll get into some of the earth's resources. I was going to sing, we've been doing patriotic songs. I was going to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic today, but we've run out of time and I don't want to keep you late. We will sing that next week. Let me close in prayer. Our Father, we thank you. We thank you for giving us the gift of government to restrain evil and reward and encourage what is good. Thank you for giving government to do good for us. And we pray that you would guide the current leaders that we have, and through the elections, guide people as they decide how to vote, and grant to us wise and good leaders that are elected in this upcoming election, we pray. Guide our government to understand this and our nation to understand these things about taxes as well and what is fair and right in your eyes. Help us, O Lord, as a nation and individually, help us to be wise in how we vote. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. See you next week.